Our guest is United States Senator Jacob Javits, Republican of New York State. Senator Javits is serving his third term as United States Senator, his 25th year in elective office, and he's now campaigning for the re-election of President Nixon. Senator, you were one of the leaders in the fight to keep the anti-busing bill from coming to a vote in the Senate last week. You supported the filibuster against it, and filibusters are generally supported by Southern senators, not Northern liberals like you. Why? Why did you do that?
Well, the first thing one does is to deny it was a filibuster and insist that it was for the education of the Senate and the country. And in this case, I think there's some substance to it, to that point, because the bill was not referred to a committee. The proponents of the bill, led by Senator Allen of Alabama, kept it on the calendar, which you can do in the Senate. So we had a right to say to the Senate, as the evidence hasn't been heard, we have to do the best we can to supply the data. So much for that. Now as to the reason for it, I believe that three factors are important. The first and most important is that in this perfervid atmosphere, just before a presidential election, we did not feel that the bill could have that objective consideration to which, considering its importance, it was entitled. And I said time and again, and I repeat now, in a state where I know there's strong feeling about the anti-busing law, that I, for one, am ready to take it up the moment the election's over, special session, January, any time, so that the Senate and the Congress can work their will.
You said the rush to pass the bill was politically motivated. What were you talking about?
I didn't say that. I said in this perfervid a quote from, I beg your pardon, I didn't realize.
It was a quote that was attributed
to
you.
Well, it was not, I don't recall having said any such thing, but I don't challenge any paper, but I had no such thing in mind that it was politically motivated. Something I never, it wouldn't be an expression I would use. I did use the expression perfervid atmosphere, and that's what it was. Now, if you define politically motivated as meaning that a bill like that could not get the objective consideration it's entitled to, and I haven't given you my reason yet why, in the atmosphere of a pre-election when people are running for Senate, like Bob Griffin is here, with busing as a big issue, I understand, and the president's for the anti-busing, some bill, it was never really clear whether he was for this one. That's what I call a perfervid atmosphere, and McGovern is on the other side. Now, let me explain the reason. The reason is that the courts are now beginning to do a very good job in this field, and the Supreme Court itself, the allegedly conservative court of Justice Berger, as contrasted with Warren, has laid down ground rules which materially limit busing. Second, I can explain, I don't want to, you know, make long answers.
Don't have a filibuster. Speaking of Senator Griffin, Senator Griffin was quoted as saying, he accused, and I heard this personally, liberal McGovern Democrats for being responsible for the filibuster. Are you a liberal McGovern Democrat?
Well, I'm not. I'm a liberal, but I'm not a liberal McGovern Democrat. I'm for the president and other Republicans, among them Senator Weicker of Illinois, Senator Weicker of Connecticut, Senator Percy of
There were 12, including
yes,
you.
Why
would Senator Griffin make that statement and try to put it on the backs of the Democrats, the McGovern Democrats?
Senator Griffin's here, very articulate and very available to you. You better ask him. But may I finish the answer?
Please do.
Because it's important. It's informative.
Please do.
See, the court has now laid down the following ground rules. One, that busing will not be resorted to except to enforce desegregation, not racial balance. Now, this is the big red herring drawn across that trail. One, so racial balance, the courts will not order busing for that, but to redress segregation where it's necessary. Second, that it must not interfere with the health of the child, length of time of busing, etc. Third, that it must not interfere with the education of the child. Fourth, very important, especially to suburbanites, that it will not interfere with the education of the child in the school to which that child is being bused. Now, let's give the courts a chance to enforce those ground rules instead of mucking the thing up in a confrontation between the Congress and the courts. Remember, the court's duty is to adjudicate what's to be done when something is being done that's unconstitutional. That's the court's job. So if the Congress is going to get into that, you've got a confrontation in this way. we could pass this bill, and the courts would then say it's unconstitutional. Now, I don't want to get into that situation in this country when it's unnecessary.
Senator, I agree with you 100%. Well, I have said time and again over this microphone, there will be no busing, cross-district busing, because if you read the latest Supreme Court decisions, it's very evident that it's not going to happen. But it's people like Senator Griffin and President Nixon who heat up this country and use this as a political issue. And that's precisely what I'm addressing myself to.
And I know you're going to ask me in a few minutes why I support Nixon. So as
no,
soon
I'm going to wait.
As soon
for
as
that.
You get to it, I'll tell
I'm
you.
I'm going to wait for that. I'm going to ask you that. I'm going to ask you that at the end.
You're going to build it up.
That's
real good.
Right, precisely. You were on the other side of a filibuster, and the vote on legislation would have created an independent protection agency for consumers of this
right.
country. A wonderful bill.
Right.
You were one of the co-sponsors, as I recall.
I'm
you
one
and
of its
Senator
authors,
Percy
and Ribicoff and I.
And we felt it was an urgently needed piece of legislation.
Right.
The filibuster kept it from coming to a vote, and you and Senator Percy joined as chief sponsor, Senator Rivikoff, in saying the White House was responsible for the defeat of the bill. Why would the White House oppose that piece of legislation?
I didn't say that. Percy is said to have said it, but I did not say
I read
White
that
House
in the New York Times.
Well, it's, but I did not say, I don't think the Times quoted me in words. But anyhow, be that as it may, the fact is that the White House had some hand in it, I'm sure. But I didn't make the accusation against them. The fact is that my colleagues, who I think were motivated by the belief that we were trying to do too much too soon and that we were putting too dangerous restraints or putting dangerous responsibilities in one agency which could be used against American business, really did this in. Now, the reason for the whatever opposition the White House contributed to, in my judgment, is that they did not want a three-man group, or I think we called it a consumer advisors or something, in the White House, which was contained in the bill, and they did not want the authority in an independent agency. They wanted it in somebody like Virginia Now, or is in the White House now. They were willing to beef up the authority, but were not willing to have a separate agency. Well, this is just a big difference of opinion between me and them. And between Percy and them, and certainly between Rebikoff.
Differences of opinion. For example, you were one of many, many senators who successfully voted to override the president's veto on the Clean Water Bill. You were one of many senators, Republicans included, that voted to defeat the president this week also on the matter of giving him a line veto on appropriations, on trying to keep this spending bill to $250 billion. The president vetoed the child development bill that you co-sponsored
with
Mondale. He worked on a pension reform bill that would protect people's pensions and permit them to move their rights from job to job. The president opposed this.
No, that's not correct, but go on.
Well, the president didn't help.
No, I wouldn't
say
that.
I mean, we were told that if the president had gotten some votes up there and said he wanted it, we could have it.
Well
let me
go on. Make the catalog.
All right, Briefly, you were for the minimum wage. The president was against. The president vetoed the Unemployment and Office of Economic Opportunity Bill, which you were for. You broke with the president when he vetoed the Hill-Burton Bill for hospital construction. You broke with him on his veto of $4.4 billion for the Office of Education, his veto of the unsuccessful attempt to pass a spending limitation bill in 1970, his veto of the Manpower Training Bill. Why would the president oppose these bills, which you, as a dedicated public servant, felt were so badly needed?
Of course, the first answer, Lou, is that he could ask me, why do I oppose him? In other words, there's a selectivity about each of these measures. There are many measures in which I'm with him. We'll get to some of those. But I'd like to just take two examples because it's interesting.
Could we stop for just a moment and
sure,
come back?
Anytime.
Okay, we'll be right back. Senator, I yield to you.
Well, thank you very much. On the consumer agency bill, for example, I've explained his differences with us. I'd like to give you one other thing because it's very important. On the pension and welfare funds, these are private pension and welfare funds. He's proposed the bill, which is called the Rule of 50. I'm not going to bemuse your listeners with the details of that. It differs from my bill, which we think, Senator Williams and I, who sponsor, he's chairman of the committee, which I'm ranking member, is a very good bill. Labor is very strongly back of it. Well, this is a legitimate difference. I don't think the president's right, but it is a difference. On the minimum wage, for example, we're for $2. The administration is too, but it wants what's called a youth differential. American labor is very strongly against the youth differential. We see some merit in their situation. All that I'm pointing out, though, is that it's not black and white always. I mean, in other words, my reason for differing with him is a substantive reason, and I wouldn't say his position is out of reason. And remember, too, that that senators have been compared, not unfairly, with King John's barons. And this is not an unfair comparison, because we are in our own states. That's where we have our political power. We must represent our states. And my people, I believe, in New York, have elected me because I stand for some things. I'm not an automaton. I'm not, you know, counting the mail. But they know what I am and what I represent. I'm not going to cheat them because I disagree with the president or agree with them. And then, for example, I'm very strongly on the whole for Nixon's foreign policy. I was very strongly, and indeed the group with which I'm closely associated in the Senate, pioneered the wage and price control. Now, those are very big things. I'm sure you could count 20 things, or 5 or 10, give any number you wish, in which I'm not with them. But often one thing will overshadow those.
You don't have to justify your being a Republican. Well, I mean, you do that to your people in New York. John Lindsay appeared on this program on October 1st, and when I asked him why he'd become a Democrat, he said, and I'm quoting him, "The Republican Party has made a sharp turn to the right. It is not the old party of Eisenhower Dewey that it used to be. It's no longer the chief flag carrier of liberalism on the Republican side. We have a conservative party in New York State now, which is a very strongly conservative party. Governor Rockefeller has led the Republican Party into a partnership with it. They have joint electors for the election of Nixon." Now, you and Rockefeller have been close allies, and how do you feel about his partnership with the conservatives who ran Jim Buckley against you 4 years ago?
Well, didn't run against me. He ran against Goodell. Oh, 4 years.
4 years
yes,
ago.
Yes, you're
he
right.
Ran against
oh,
you.
Well, it's yes. Nothing. People can run against me. I don't get mad at that. I don't think that's true about Rockefeller. Now, I don't say that in any sense that John Lindsay isn't telling the truth, but I mean, the fact, the conclusion he draws, I thoroughly disagree with. Rockefeller has not gone conservative, and remember, he opposed in 1968 the Republican electors on the conservative line, and they were not. And Nixon lost the state. Now, I don't know that he'd have carried it on that line. I don't think he would. But nonetheless, he lost it. Now, this time, with an incumbent president, I think Rockefeller and I joined in the decision. Don't just include Rockefeller, not me. We put it up to the president. Did he want that line? And he said he did.
Or
he felt he
line.
Did. He felt he did. I mean, you know, I can't quote the president. I don't want to quote him. But the position was that he wanted it. And if he wanted it, we couldn't deny it to him as a sitting president. And in other things, for example, Rockefeller vetoed an anti-abortion bill. Rockefeller vetoed an anti-busing bill, notwithstanding that his legislature was the other way. That's hardly the mark of a man who's going conservative.
Now, I do think... It's the mark of a man with courage, I think.
Well, it is the mark of a man with great courage, and he has it. Now, I do think that he's gone quite conservative on money. And I can hardly blame him, because he's taken an awful beating on the fact that people say when he gets elected, he raises taxes. He came very close to being defeated on that issue. And so he's a kind of gun shy.
But these fellows, for example, Vice President Agnew helped defeat your liberal Republican colleague, Charlie Goodell, who was a darn good senator. Agnew is one heartbeat away from the presidency. You proposed that the president dump him as a running mate. How do you feel about Agnew being one heartbeat away from the presidency and possible presidential nominee in 1976, or likely presidential nominee?
I have stated before, and I state again, that I haven't changed my mind about the vice president, and I urge the president at the proper time to review the bidding, quote, point being to look over other candidates. But he wanted Agnew, and that's the ticket, and I'm for the ticket, and therefore I feel that it's my job to do my utmost to keep the party on a more moderate line than Agnew would preach now, and to do everything I can, as well as pray, for the fact that Agnew will, in the next 4 years, mature as a different type of man. An interesting thing about Agnew is this. When he ran for governor of Maryland, I went over and campaigned for him, because when he came out of being county executive of that county, I think it's Baltimore County, he had a pretty good reputation, especially with the blacks, in terms of civil rights. And I felt justified in campaigning for him. So Adlai Stevenson once said something to me that's very amusing, which is apposite to this. We were at a dinner, and somebody said, "Well, why am I not a Democrat?" Just, you know, like you intimated here a minute ago. And Adlai said, "Well, I can understand why he's a Republican, but I want him to know that we'll always keep a little light burning in the window for him."
Well, speaking,
I feel the same way about Agnew.
Well, speaking of that, Lindsey said, obviously, left the Republican Party. Ogden Reed, a Republican congressman, left the Republican Party. You think the day will come when you will leave the Republican
Party?
Well,
my answer to that is no, as far as I can see. And I'd like to, again, give you a little history briefly.
You feel isolated with Lindsey out, Reed out?
No, there are at least...
Republicans joining the conservatives, and the conservatives are talking about running Jack Kemp against you.
Anybody.
Republicans in 2 years, who's a former quarterback, who's a Republican congressman, who's a conservative, of knocking you out in the primary.
Well, I'm in such good shape, Lou, that I'll become a halfback, going one better. But seriously, the talk about running people against me in the primary is fine. That's their privilege. But I don't feel a bit isolated. There are, in my judgment, at least 15 senators who feel very much as I do in the Senate, and I feel that a liberal point of view in the Republican Party is more necessary than ever, and I think it's fair to say for my people in New York that I have been able to do as much, I think, as any other senator in this century in terms of the things that they're deeply interested in doing. Because the Senate, on the whole, is pretty open-minded. I'd like to give you a little example of that. If I put up an amendment they like, they'll vote for it, the most conservative. And if the most conservative man puts up an amendment that I like, I'll vote for it. I think, from that point of view, I don't feel a bit isolated or unhappy. Incidentally, the greatest time when there was any danger of my leaving the party was when Wayne Morse left it. Because I was then a congressman, and we were very close, and he came to me and asked me to do it. And I felt that if the two-party system was going to survive, and I told Wayne this, and he's a wonderful man, I said, if the two-party system is going to survive, then we've got to keep the spectrum in each party.
But being concerned about the two-party system surviving, and in 1964, when you were very much opposed to Goldwater, my recollection is you didn't campaign for Johnson.
I did not campaign for Johnson or Goldwater.
And recognizing the two-party system, here you have the President of the United States endorsing a Democratic senator in Mississippi, Jim Eastland, the Republican candidate down there, Carmichael, being practically ostracized. Kleindienst is down there campaigning for Eastland. And the President obviously has a position, according to the polls, where he may carry all 50 states. He's not campaigning for any Republicans. Is that in the interest of the two-party system?
Well, you're very vulnerable on that one, Lou, because Franklin D. Roosevelt, the saint of the Democratic Party, tried to purge a Democratic senator, as I recall it, I think it was in Georgia, and came out very second
Carter best. Glass.
Well, no, that was Virginia, but I think he tried to purge somebody in Georgia. Just my memory.
In other words, it's not
unsymptomatic of presidents.
No, but
he didn't actually endorse Eastland. It's said that all the indicia are that he's not for Eastland, that he's...
But I agree, we need a two-party system, and a viable two-party system, where people have a choice. And I think the President is contributing, in one sense, to the demise of the Republican Party in the South, and in the other sense, trying to resurrect it. We have to stop for a moment. We'll be back. Senator Javits, you've opposed the President on many of his appointments, several of his appointments to the United States Supreme Court.
The most noteworthy, as I recall, being G. Harold Carswell and Clement Haynsworth. Did you oppose him on others, too?
No, I think those were the only two. Yeah. Though I think I voted no on Rehnquist.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Approximately half of the Nixon judicial appointees for the other courts have been placed in the lowest category of qualifications by the American Bar Association. Are you concerned with what four more years of Nixon will do to the Supreme Court and to the lower courts of this country?
Well, I am concerned about what any president will do to the courts. I think in, for example, juxtaposed to your statement about the ABA, which I hadn't seen, or with any other president comparison, which also I hadn't seen, as to whether Nixon's doing worse or better. The appointments in New York, I think, have been uniformly high, and we have made quite a few appointments between Senator Buckley and myself, in the sense we nominate and they approve or disapprove. And as to the Supreme Court, I think the fact is that President Nixon says that he wants a conservative majority. Well, that's one of the drawbacks of Nixon, as far as I'm concerned, as contrasted with his strengths in Moscow, Peking, price and wage control, lots of other things. I simply have to evaluate it, and I've come out on his side because I believe that on the present conditions, he's the best prescription for the country. But to say that I agree with him, you've already cataloged many things, or that I, even in the future, I'm going to fight like a tiger for what I believe in, even though my man may be elected President of the United States.
Several weeks ago, Alfred McCoy appeared on this program. I'm sure you know who he is. He's testified before congressional committees on the heroin traffic and the involvement of the governments in Southeast Asia.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. He wrote a book.
He wrote a book. We asked the White House to send a spokesman to respond to him. They tried for 3 weeks and said they didn't come up with anybody. Essentially, he said that our CIA and the administration was heavily involved with the governments of South Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand, and hooking our GIs on drugs. Do you want to respond to any Mr. McCoy's allegations?
No, I really can't, but I will say that I'm too old to be surprised, and I will say that in this or any other administration, any kind of skullduggery, whether it's Watergate or heroin or anything else, must be unearthed, and that we simply have to fight those battles all the time with everybody. But let me give you an example, Lou. At the time of the 5% of business with Harry Truman, who would anybody have believed that history would then evaluate him as one of the best American presidents? I mean, you go through that always. And the fact that eternal vigilance is with any administration, is
The point that concerns many of us, that when the vicuna coat came, or the deep freeze with Harry Vaughan, he was canned. He was out. When the vicuna coat came up with Bernard Goldfein and Sherman Adams, he was out. Mm-hmm. And as long as you brought up the Watergate matter, we now have all these things going on, the Watergate and many others. And the White House, there's no denials from the White House. They're just ridiculing the newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time Magazine, who have done an excellent job investigative reporting, in my judgment. And they refuse to deny any of these things. And nobody's fired. And now we have Wednesday's New York Times having Donald Segretti's credit card, the guy who was supposed to be in charge of the espionage thing, showing that he made phone calls to Dwight Chapin in the White House, who was Nixon's appointments man, and to Dwight Chapin at home. And, you know, nobody says anything about this. How do you, as a decent man, feel about these
things? Well, in the first place, I feel Watergate's reprehensible, and I feel it needs to be completely investigated, and I'm glad that Kennedy's committee is going to begin to look into it. I was glad the grand jury, incidentally, which was a holdover grand jury, not one created for the purpose, indicted the fellows that it did indict. Now, you're a little inaccurate about what the White House has said. The White House has said that anybody who's implicated will be fired. They won't have him directly or indirectly. He said that yesterday, Ziegler. And that the president, repeated again, the president has no connection with it, no knowledge of it. Now it is the latter point, which you must accept the president at his word until proven otherwise. And as to firing people, I think it's perfectly right that they too, like any other American who's accused, should have an opportunity, but via the president, to look it over and see if the accusation is justified. I'm too much of a lawyer, just because it was on Segretti's credit card or the New York Times said so, to assume Chapin's guilty. But I believe the president will fire him if he finds that he had any connection with this, whatever.
But Senator, the White House's attitude has been consistently, they began by Ziegler saying they had no comment on the Watergate, it was a third class burglary kind of thing.
And it's pretty obvious to me, and I'm sure to you, that they're trying to sweep all this under the rug until after November 7th. Your colleague, Senator Muskie, whom I know you respect, the Canuck letter, which now is allegedly written by Ken Clausen, one of the Herb Klein's deputies. These things, I mean, I get depressed reading about them, and I become even more depressed about the public's failure to be concerned, and even more depressed when I see the White House coming up with smart-aleck statements in which they say, like Clark McGregor the other night, I'm sure you saw it, he comes to a news conference, he reads a statement, and he won't submit to any questions. Unbelievable. Walks out of the room.
Well, the people have a way of judging that also, and the fact that the country is not excited about it must mean that they're not, that they don't think there's enough to it to be excited about. And that's in essence what I'm saying up to now. And the fact that an effort should be made because there is a political campaign to, as it were, you know, play it down, well, that's understandable. Listen, the president's human, I'm human, you are. What do you expect him to do? Make a big thing of something which can be deeply embarrassing? And I think their philosophy, look, I'll do everything I can to get every fact revealed by my party or the president or anybody else. But you can understand their feeling that they feel if you deny something, it's already a grain of admission that you know something about it. So they're trying to keep as far away from it as possible.
Do you have a high regard for James Reston?
Yes, I think very highly of Scotty Reston.
All right, let me read this quote in his column this last week. And what's worse, these destructive tactics are regarded by many people as being, single quote, very clever. Not a single member of the old, respectable Republican establishment has asked the president publicly to speak out for the honor of the party and the republic. Have you asked the president to speak out?
I have asked my party and I've asked the president, but I think you've, again, I repeat, I think what Scotty Reston says is perfectly proper and entirely creditable, but you must remember that the president has a right to feel that if he takes cognizance of this in that way, that he moves to deny it, that immediately gives a certain percentage of the people the feeling that he knows something about it or had something to do with it. So it's very difficult to put the blame on him for that reason. You can write a good editorial about it, but Scotty Reston isn't running, and Nixon is, and he's human.
But what Scotty Reston is saying, somebody should speak out in the Republican Party.
But do we have enough evidence to say that somebody should speak out without giving the president a chance to fire anybody who he thinks had any connection
with? No, but I think you add that to the ITT case, the Warner-Lambert case, the wheat deal, the awarding of a Postal Service bond to Peter Flanagan's brokerage firm, the refusal to disclose over $10 million in campaign funds, and I think the laundering of money by Mexican banks, and I think a senator like yourself, who is respected, I think, by both parties, I wonder how you react to all
this. Well, I react very badly. But I have to evaluate that, too, in terms of what's proven, in terms of the president's connection with it. And as yet, I don't think anything is proven. So I can't be quite as reckless as I might be if I were writing an editorial.
Now I'll ask you the question.
Please.
Why are you out campaigning for Richard Nixon in view of these differences, in view of the fact that his wing of the Republican Party has sought on many occasions to damage you and may very well, in fact, try to defeat you in 2 years. And ideologically, in my judgment, you're miles apart.
I'm for Richard Nixon because I believe that considering the major things which are mountains in American life, which have been done, the breakthrough for peace, notwithstanding my deep differences with him on ending the Vietnam War in terms of Peking and Moscow, the stabilization of the inflationary situation in this country, and the general feeling of capacity and strength in handling the country's situation, which was close to anarchic, I believe that he is the right prescription for the country at this time, and I would be less than a patriotic American if, notwithstanding these differences, I wasn't for it having a sincere evaluation that way. And I believe the American people and my own people in New York are adult enough to appreciate that I'm never going to be a man who's going to vote yah with any president. I mean, I'd love Dwight Eisenhower, and he got awful mad at me on occasion in connection with civil rights matters. And we were very close, and I'm very proud of it. And with President Nixon, that's my situation. Really, honestly, deeply, I've shown I'm not afraid not to support a Republican candidate for president. I really believe this is the best for the country.
Some people have suggested, not me, that you've taken this position in campaigning for the president, hoping that in turn they do not oppose you in 2 years. How do you respond to that?
If anybody thinks that I'd be afraid to take on anything in New York, I doubt that it's a New Yorker.
Last question. What kind of a man, you know George McGovern, what kind of a man do you consider him to be?
He's a decent, honorable, high-minded man who, unfortunately, based upon his experience, policies, and credentials, cannot do the job the country needs to have done in the next 4 years, so he isn't going to do very well, in my judgment, in this election. In addition, he has been unable to crash through with anything really convincing to the American people. You have made a lot better case right now in this broadcast than he seems to have been able to make in all his months of campaigning.
Senator, I thank you very much. I've always had a high regard for you, and it's been a pleasure to have you. I hope you'll come back someday.
Thank you.
Now what?